friend.
Hey, girl, hey.
Welcome back. Welcome back to our listeners and our viewers. I'm really excited for this episode. How about you?
Yeah, because I think that I don't always have the most optimistic view of politics. And our guest today, Amanda Hunter, is going to let us know about what women are facing in politics, what is encouraging, what are the challenges. And what I know about Amanda and the work that she does through the Barbara Lee Foundation is that they believe that much of the issue that we are seeing with women's electability can be solved.
Yeah, and we're seeing it happen in some of our communities, and we just need to keep mimicking that model. Even in a system that's structurally perverse, there's a way to prevail.
And we're going to talk all about that today. But before we get there, we have a sponsor for today's episode, a sponsor that you and I know very well.
Yeah.
Because it's us.
So today's episode is sponsored by our private community, the Justice League. This is a new space that recently opened to our listeners and viewers. It is important that if you're interested, and we hope you are, because there's going to be a lot of exclusive content, a lot of information and activity and new episodes that are not available for public consumption, that you do so soon, because we're going to be capping enrollment over the next couple weeks.
For sure. And we feel like this is just a natural extension of the conversations that we have either in the comments on YouTube, the comments that you all leave on the actual audio podcast, or over on social media. But those conversations are all happening in this disparate fashion. And we felt like the private community was a place to allow them to happen in one place.
And one of the things that also became clear right after the first season was that people really wanted to continue having these conversations, both online and offline.
Yes.
And so the private community will be a space to foster community and also continuing to have conversations around topics that might be hard to talk about in other venues.
For sure. So please make sure to join us. Again, it is time sensitive, and also it is a cap on membership. So if you're into it, I say go ahead, pull the plug, take the plunge, and join us over on Mighty Networks. Information will be in the description box or the show notes.
Okay, so now it's time to go to our next section of our episode, but we're going to do it in a little bit of an unorthodox way for us, which is dumb shit people say. And we have our incredible guest, Amanda.
So what is it, Amanda, that you have heard, and you mentioned this to us earlier, that is just a dumb quote that you hear often?
I think a lot of us hear this often from our friends, family, and neighbors, but questioning a woman's electability, saying, I'd vote for her, but I don't know if she's electable. I don't know if other people would. Or I'd vote for a woman, just not her. Just not her. Someone else, though, sure. And it really comes down to stereotypes at the end of the day and people believing that women are not electable. And we like to say they're electable if you vote for them. It's as simple as that. And we know from our research that people believe that women are electable for executive office. And when we tested women from all different racial backgrounds, each woman either tied or won her ballot against a straight white man of the opposite party. So women are electable. People need to change their mind frame around this.
Do you think, Amanda, that people say that as a cop-out just because of misogyny?
It seems like it's such internalized misogyny that sometimes when we have focus groups, we'll ask people, would you vote for a woman? Would you vote for this candidate? And then, do you think your friends and neighbors would? And they'll say, I would, but my neighbor, probably not. And that deep down probably indicates that they also do not think that this candidate is electable, and they don't feel comfortable saying that. Or they may not even realize it. It might not be conscious.
I think people hearing this may think that this only applies to men's perspective on women's electability. But do you find a through line there for how women see other women as well?
Absolutely. Women can have just as much internalized misogyny as men can. And we definitely see that in our focus groups. And it's striking, I think, when you look back at the 2020 primary election cycle, for example, you saw candidates like Secretary Pete Buttigieg or Beto O'Rourke, who on paper had less experience than all four of the women senators in the Democratic primary, yet it was the four women senators who constantly had their electability questioned. And that is just what we see all the time. Women have to do much more to prove that they are qualified.
Yeah, and I'm so excited to just dig deeper into that. I told Margo, I was like, I met Amanda. She is just this bastion of knowledge and data. And how does she know all of these things?
And kind of what you bring to this conversation, and we're going to talk a little bit about your bio in a second just to frame the conversation for our listeners, is some perspective that's nonpartisan, which I don't think we get often.
For sure.
And information around women, women in politics, women in places of power. But I want to kind of stay on this idea of electability a little bit, because I remember saying once, it was actually in response to President Barack Obama and how, who I loved, and how people always described his speaking style and his leadership style as dynamic, right? That he was a person that could speak to everyone, that he could speak to small audiences, big audiences, black folks, white folks, right? Young people, old people, he got people excited. And this adjective, dynamic. And I said to my husband at the time, I said, I don't think I've ever heard a woman described as dynamic. I would argue that all women are dynamic because they are constantly having to modulate their messaging based on whatever group they're in front of. But this idea of that being a superpower is not something that often translates in public consciousness to women. And I'm wondering kind of if you can speak to that.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's definitely not fair. Certainly, President Obama was in many ways a once-in-a-lifetime leader. But if you've ever been in the room when Stacey Abrams is giving a speech and cried in public, or the vice president, I just saw her speak last month and she brought the house down. And they certainly don't get credit for that because...
They certainly don't get publicity for it.
Because for women, the standard is perfection. So if they're meeting the basic standard of perfection, they don't get credit for it in politics. They just may not get criticized. Whereas the bar is so much lower for men that they're celebrated even if they're just meeting expectations or maybe exceeding a little bit.
That's so difficult to think that in your existence and doing very important work, your fight is to not consistently be condemned and criticized. And you see day to day that that does not apply to your male counterparts.
Or that the expectation placed on you is perfection.
That's bullshit.
Particularly when we see, I mean, there's so many reasons that perfection should never be the goalpost, but also the kind of blatant hypocrisy when we see their male counterparts of both parties flagrantly violating laws, each other, decorum,
ethics,
taxes.
All the things.
Or even a gaffe. I mean, something as simple as John Kerry putting Swiss cheese on his Philly cheesesteak when he was on the campaign trail, people kind of laughed about that for a couple of days. But when Senator Gillibrand, on the same presidential campaign trail, ate a piece of fried chicken with a fork and a knife, it was the four-day news story, and people said that it seemed like she was hiding something, and it had a kind of sinister undertone. Rather than just being able to say, oh, haha, I didn't want to get my face dirty. Right.
Like hiding an eating disorder? What are you hiding in your fried chicken?
It was very inappropriate, but it was just one example of what we saw in the primary for women having to spend days on invented gaffes and crises.
Also, again, like, don't even get me started on this concept of like women and not be, women eating and women eating publicly. It's like you can't even basically function in public as a woman without being criticized in this space.
It's difficult, and in this case, because the stereotype for hundreds of years has been straight white men dominating political roles. We talk about how so many voters have what we call an imagination barrier. They just can't picture somebody who looks different in that role. And then when somebody is, they can make very undermining comments towards that person. And that I believe, is the root of a lot of the criticism we see towards women in politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think oftentimes that there are all of these microcosms in our world. If we just peeled back a couple layers, we could see so easily the patriarchy, the cisnormative values, all of these societal issues that exist are right on display. And I think that this is one of the most obvious ones we've ever had in our lifetime in the founding of this country. And to deny the work that you do, I just couldn't imagine being in that mind space. And it's also why it is so important that your work is nonpartisan, I think.
So yeah, before we jump into our questions, Amanda, can you tell our listeners and viewers a little bit about yourself and your role?
Definitely. So I'm the executive director of the Barbara Lee Family Foundation, which seeks to elevate women's representation in the fields of politics and contemporary art. And I grew up in Massachusetts. I had long idolized our founder, Barbara Lee, not the congresswoman. Barbara is a philanthropic activist, but they're friends, which makes it extra confusing.
That's adorable.
But I had long idolized her, and she had just been a hero of mine, and I always said if I could ever work for her, I would love to. But that's never going to happen, right? Because we always have to qualify those things ourselves. And I was living in D.C. I worked in communications and various roles in Washington for 15 years. Never thought I would leave. And then a job became open on Barbara's team, and I said, I'm just going to send in my resume, but I'm not going to see if I know anybody or anything. And then within 3 weeks, I was moving to Boston to work for Barbara. Wow. And it's just been incredible. That was after the first Women's March in 2017. So we were able to ride the wave of record numbers of women getting elected to office. Mm. And Barbara's a hero of mine because she started this in the late 90s because her dream is to see a woman president. And she realized that the path to the presidency is through governor's mansions and Senate seats. And so we have studied every gubernatorial race involving a woman since 1998. And Barbara is in a position that she can just be fearless and take things on behalf of women that other people maybe had no interest in doing or can't. And that is why I wanted to work for her. I think that a lot of people in this space living in Washington get involved in supporting candidates because they want something for themselves. Mm. And Barbara she really doesn't. She really just wants to see a woman president in her lifetime. And it's so liberating to not have to try to be getting permits for a factory or something when you're interfacing with leaders.
Yeah, I mean, it's so kind of, I don't know if novel is the right word, that it's not performative or strategic for her own personal gain, right? You see people who try to get close to people in power or elected representatives, right, for their own, like you said, economic or
their ego.
Or whatever cause that they're aligned with or has been in their personal experience, right? Yeah. But it's for them. And it's really wonderful to model or to see someone who's doing it just because they believe that more women should be in office.
Yeah, for sure. Can you set the stage for us right now? I mean, I tell people often that I'm an attorney, but depending on what room I'm in, I masquerade as a statistician because I'm fascinated. I don't know why she's laughing. She often underplays my immense talents, Amanda.
No, she's a really good statistician. She also has her PhD in everything, but
everything. Because when I'm interested in it, I'm a dog
just,
with a bone.
It's just sometimes I haven't heard the statistician thing before.
Okay, Margo, I'm working on some things. Okay. So let me put my statistician hat back on. I'm sorry, Amanda. I find data to be so fascinating. And so so now you're interested in that was such overcompensation. Thank you, friend. You have this huge data set. So comparing then to now, what are you seeing? What is the climate right now for women in politics?
Well, a lot of things have changed, fortunately. And I'll say the negative first because Barbara always likes us to end on a positive note.
I love it.
So for women, we've identified consistently for the last 20 plus years the three main challenges for women seeking executive office. And these things show up in all of our studies. So one is qualifications, that voters assume that men are qualified. They can simply release their resume and it's taken at face value. I'm sure we've all seen that in real life.
Well, so I know you can't say it, but we've had ongoing discussions around George Santos.
as an example of as what Amanda is saying,
of,
for sure.
Of kind of no one fact-checking his resume, and it was all created.
If a man looks the part, it's just a lot easier for voters to assume that they're qualified. And I think we see this in the business world, too. Mm. When there's a job posted and it says 8 to 10 years experience, a man might say, I have 6, but I'm qualified. Whereas a woman's like, I don't know, I have 9.5, and I don't know if it's quite 10. I don't know if I'm totally going to get it. And it's because of all of these stereotypes that we see. So when a woman seeks executive office, it's not just enough to say, I graduated from the Harvard Kennedy School. It's, well, what did she actually do there? And how was she actually admitted? And people want more details and more evidence that women accomplished something. So that's the first burden that we've consistently seen. The next one is likability, which sounds like a positive thing, but it is not. Likability is not good because it also is used in a sexist way sometimes. We've all probably remember the Hillary Clinton, she's likable enough moment. But why it's dangerous is because voters will not support a woman if they don't like her, even if they believe she's qualified, and they will vote for a man if they don't think he's a nice person, if they think that he's qualified. Yeah. And we see those stereotypes all the time. How many people have made excuses for a man in the business world that's a hothead or is always yelling at people, and women so don't brilliant. Have that luxury? Yeah, and I've seen even Bernie Sanders has been labeled adorably grumpy, and his, you know, his kind of demeanor is celebrated yep. in yep. a way that a woman would not be able to get away
at all
with any of that. Mm-mm. So that's the second one, and the third one is what we call the ethical pedestal. So voters assume that women are more trustworthy and more moral than men, which sounds like a positive, and I think it has roots in the suffrage movement when women argued if they were allowed to vote, they would clean up politics and make them less corrupt. The problem is, once a woman is knocked off of her pedestal, even with an accusation of wrongdoing,
yeah.
it's very hard to climb back up. So Hillary Clinton and her emails are obviously the most famous recent example of that.
Yep.
But you look at scandals like Governor Sanford lying about his whereabouts, getting caught having an affair. He's still going to events in the Republican Party. He's still going on TV and doing interviews. And when we could probably talk about different men that have done this for this entire podcast. Women would not get a second chance. And so even an accusation, whether it's true or not, voters don't remember when it's found out to not be true. It's, hey, wasn't she the one who gave a job to her brother-in-law that wasn't qualified? And they don't remember, oh, wait, that was debunked a couple of months later. So that's incredibly damaging for women candidates.
And it feels like it also goes back to one of the first things you said, Amanda, which is the standard of perfection. Mm-hmm. And so not being able to bounce back, not being expected. I mean, I lived in Washington, D.C., as you did for many years. Famously, Mayor Marion Barry, who is still beloved to this mm-hmm. day, we know was caught in a hotel room smoking crack cocaine. Like, there were many other allegations as well. He came back and was elected again. And mm-hmm. I'm saying nothing about why or why not someone who has a substance abuse disorder order is electable, of course, but what I'm saying is, to your point, I could not imagine if mm-hmm. that was mm-hmm. a woman. The standard has always been perfection.
Mm-hmm. And this idea of perfection and its double-edged sword, right? Because is a female candidate a mother or is she not a mother? Because if she's a mother, she's not being a good mother if she's, I mean, I'm not saying this, by the way. I'm saying, like, the public perception mm-hmm. is that she's not a good mother because she's not available to her children. But if she's not a mother, then she doesn't know the plight of mothers.
Absolutely. And we have found that as well in our research. And we even hear, when we do presentations to cohorts of elected officials, women will say that often it's other women that come up to them in public and ask, what is the plan for taking care of your children? Who's going to be watching them while you're working? Because voters want to know. And that's part of our advice. Barbara doesn't just like to identify biases. She likes to give women the tools to overcome the biases, because we have to work within the structures that we have. We would love to erase a lot of these biases completely, but that's going to take time and getting more diverse people elected. So in the meantime, we have to just study what voters think and then give women practical tips. So okay. for the children, we tell women to remain patient and calm, which is hard because it's frustrating, and to offer matter-of-fact answers My parents live down the street. They're able to pick up the kids from school and then get back to policy. But not everybody has family nearby that can help out, and that's why we need to extend all-day kindergarten. But that's harder when you're in the middle of a grocery store and someone's coming up to you and asking you those questions.
And it's harder when that's not your lived experience too, right? When you don't have family or a community surrounding you and helping you, and you are paying out of pocket for a lot of childcare, which is not accessible to the average person in the United States, right? Then it becomes this question of access and privilege, and also you being a absent parent.
And men obviously don't have the same concerns from voters. In those focus groups, voters acknowledged that women were held to a double standard around childcare and then still held the women to the double standard. Anyway, because these stereotypes are so ingrained, families look totally different now than they did 50 years ago. Absolutely. But people still have a very Aussie and Harriet, if people remember those shows, or Leave It to Beaver kind of view of what families look like. And on the flip side of that, as you said, Margo, if women don't have a traditional looking family or they don't have children, voters worry that they may not be in touch with their lives and understand the struggles that families are facing. So we advise women to highlight other relationships, other family members that they love and care about. Because ultimately, if people know that you have loved ones that you might have to make healthcare decisions for or support financially, you get what it's like for other people that are doing
this. Well, we talk about this. I don't know if you heard, as a listener and viewer of the episode, you might have heard this, that we talk about this idea of being maternal as totally separate from being a mother. That's something that is a component of our conversations that we really want to elevate, because I think it's something that has harmed women in general, particularly women of our age group, in all of the settings, professional, personal, and otherwise.
And oftentimes you are the person in a family unit, both close and extended, who might be, depending on your background, the most stable. And so over the weekend, I had a conversation with an elder. She retired recently from the federal government. She had been there for over 20 years, chief of staff position. And she was just talking to me about over the years, she didn't have children, but all of her nieces, nephews, cousins, the people in her life, her church members' children, who she mentored and honestly supported financially. So not having biological children, again, has nothing to do with your maternal instinct, and for sure, knowing what it means to be supportive of families in politics, for sure.
But it's so interesting, well, not interesting, but like frustrating that this rigid notion of parenthood and motherhood.
Motherhood.
Translate. Because it's not translating to fatherhood.
It is
well,
not.
Exactly. And candidates that are dads get what we call the dad extra credit if they're at the kids' soccer game or if
they're... Well, I was thinking of this as last night when we were talking about Ron DeSantis and his three kids at the Iowa State Fair, right? If a woman had a three-year-old and was running for president, can you imagine the backlash they would get around their identity as a parent and being present? And he gets kudos because he takes his three-year-old out in like 90-degree weather. I don't know. It's just so weird.
It's like people saying that dads are babysitting their kids.
This is your child. Oh, that burns my biscuits. Ooh, I cannot stand that.
It's that extra credit, though, that dads get. And one thing that we are very interested in and for kind of future research, what you were talking about, that because of those maternal stereotypes that women have, it seems like that bleeds into the workplace and people have different expectations of women as a boss than they do for men. And that might be why women are attacked more for being a bad boss than men are, because we all know men who are celebrated for screaming at people at work
and celebrate it.
Exactly. And people wear it as a badge of honor to work for
those
people.
Like, I got through that administration or I worked for that. Yeah. Elected.
But that's also a common criticism that at least I hear anecdotally, which is that women are too temperamental. They're too hot-headed. Mm-hmm. They can't be even keel. What about them being on their period and them having PMS? Trump saying blood was coming out of everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this idea of this like hysteria and particularly white woman's hysteria that honestly is one of just the biases that have existed since the founding of this country.
Absolutely. And right here in Salem, in Massachusetts.
Absolutely.
And you're right. These stereotypes go back hundreds of years. And that's part of the problem. It's going to take time to break them down. And one positive thing that we talk about is that this current generation, all of the young children, are never going to remember a time that there was not a woman vice president, there were not a record number of women serving as governor, that there were not record numbers of women and people of color in Congress. And so it's not going to be acceptable to them to have people on the ballot that don't reflect the community. And I think that's when we're going to see a big sea change in voter opinion, or at least that's what we tell ourselves.
I mean, just to add one statistic in here as a statistician, I've recently heard that 1 in 5 members of Gen Z identify as part of the LGBTQ community. And so for sure, things are definitely changing because expectations will naturally change as well. But more generally, why is this important? The work of the Barbara Lee Foundation, why is it important to get women into politics?
Well, one reason is in line with one of the positive things that we see for women right now is that voters have responded really well to women showing up as what we call 360-degree candidates, bringing the entirety of their lived experience to the job. When Barbara started this work in the late 90s, women were really trying to show up in the same outdated template that men used. So women were wearing boxy suits. They were standing in front of mahogany desks. They didn't really talk about their families or the work that they had to do as mothers, maybe a stray mention. And in the last 5 years, we've seen women talking about deeply personal issues on the campaign trail, proactively bringing them up when Barbara started in the late 90s. Probably male consultants would have urged women to keep these things a secret. But in the last Senate cycle, there was a senator who had an ad about her family's struggle with addiction that was very visceral and very honest. And we've seen women talk about experiencing teen pregnancy, experiencing housing insecurity, struggles with mental illness. And what we found is that that really resonates with voters. And voters know that when there's a mother at the table, especially at this time when our research shows women are more burned out than ever, they know that women are going to be thinking about policy differently because they have a direct stake in the game in a different way. Or if you look at the mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, she spent time in public housing growing up. And so at the beginning of COVID, one of the first things that she did was enforce COVID precautions in public housing. She knew from her lived experience. I think someone who grew up in a different level of privilege would not have had that same initial thought.
Understanding of the density
and
of,
that's why
communal living in that, or a populated housing development. Yeah.
That's why voters know that women are going to see things differently through their lived experience. And that's actually resonated with voters to show that they are in touch with voters' lives and that that is a positive. And we've also found in our research on women voters that women are more burned out even than in previous years. This year, 60% of our women respondents said that they were more burned out, and 70% of women under 40. So 70? It's not a surprise, but it shows that when you see a woman leader, you may think she understands what it's like if she has children to have to work all day and then put Spirit Week costumes together when she gets home and then get the birthday presents together for the weekend, or all the emotional labor that women have to do in a family.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think it's so incredible that we have so many brave women in elected positions now that are willing and generous enough to share their stories and their personal experiences. But I feel uncomfortable with it too, that there's almost this expectation that women have to share some things in their lives that men don't in order to be believed that they care. And so I'm thinking specifically about so many women who shared their abortion stories and their miscarriage stories as all of the movement around Roe and Dobbs was happening in D.C. And I think it was incredible.
Yeah.
And unsurprising, right? We know this is an issue that affects all. And it makes me so sad for the same reason that we've talked about this, like this idea of survivor stories and people having to share their story over and over and over. This idea that you're only going to be believed if you've suffered and you share that suffering with everyone else.
That part.
That's so true. And with the Me Too movement, we saw that with sexual assault survivors and an elected speaking out on both sides of the aisle about their experience, which was very powerful, but also potentially traumatic.
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like on one hand, men are allowed, at least in this specific way, to be emotionally detached, to be despondent, to not have to show up and talk about their personal lives in any real way. If they do, they might be lying and they'll be forgiven and we'll all move on. Whereas a woman has to all but give you her psychological evaluation, her child care plan, her retirement plan, right? Every way she's going to solve
her
world hunger.
History, her housing history.
Social security number. All the things. At all times.
Well, and the retirement plan thing is a good point, too, because another critique that we hear of women is that she's ambitious. Mm. And Barbara always says that for women, ambition is a four-letter word. Mm. You hear about women who are running for office and people say, well, she's only doing that because she wants to run for X afterwards. This is just a temporary role. But for men, the expectation is, of course, they're going to seek the next level of office. Of course, they're going to be ambitious and want something. And so we've seen women have to almost diminish themselves to make their ambition seem smaller as not to threaten and be too much for voters. And in the 2020 primary, I was struck when Senator Warren, our hometown senator, said that she already had her dream job and it was being a special education teacher, because if she had said, my dream job is to be president of the United States, which she was running for at the time, that probably would have been too threatening. Oh, wow. To voters. And we know from our research, voters already don't like women who teach at a college or university because they are transferring on them that the woman thinks that she's better than they are.
We've talked a lot about people perceive women who are seeking elected office a lot, but have you seen, or what are, I should say, the nuances when we drill down intersectionally? So Black women, trans mm-hmm. women, queer women, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we found in our electability research is that the standard for holding political office is straight, white, and male. So when you deviate any of those categories, it becomes more difficult to convince voters that candidates are electable. We found that specifically for Black women candidates, it takes longer to raise money. We've heard that anecdotally. We have that in our governor's research. And women will tell us when they see our research that that's authentic to their experience, that a Black woman may get a list from a white male colleague and have to call that list 2, 3, 4 times, where the white man only has to call that list one time to get enough donations. So there's definitely a time burden for women of color. And when women of color seek executive office, they have to face racism in addition to misogyny. And people have all kinds of internalized racism, as you know, the way that they do with internalized misogyny. And we even have seen in focus groups that voters of color may not be confident that a candidate of color is electable given their lived experience. But we did find in our sexism research that people of color were more likely to believe that women experience severe sexism, likely because of their own experience with racism.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And we haven't even talked about when you deviate from all of the norms that you talked about. What about a queer Black woman?
Who's disabled. Yeah.
They're definitely going to have to work much harder to communicate their qualifications with voters and to challenge stereotypes. But the positive is that we have a number of partner organizations that support candidates from different backgrounds. So one development that I've seen over time that is really positive is there are wonderful groups that help Black women run for office, disabled people, LGBTQ candidates. And so I think that those affinity groups do so much great work to lift up candidates and identify candidates, frankly, because it is a myth that women have to be asked so many times to run for office. People repeat that a lot, which frustrates me because women aren't wallflowers sitting around waiting to be asked.
Yeah.
But there are power structures at the state level where the treasurer role only comes up every so often, and it's not your turn yet, it's this guy's turn. And that's something that we do talk about, that women are often told to wait their turn. And if they don't, then there is some shock associated and some outrage there.
Mm. Amanda, would you ever run for office?
Maybe I would someday, but I think that it's so much of a sacrifice for women, not just given all of these stereotypes that we're talking about, but one thing that a lot of electeds tell us is about the harassment and the security risks are very real. And running for office mm-hmm. at a more local level if you're a state rep, you don't have a security detail. Your address is public. So I think, especially for anyone with children, that's really terrifying. And our colleagues at an amazing organization called She Persisted, they do a lot of work on women and online harassment. And they talk about how online harassment for women will evolve into in-person harassment. So you can't just discount it and say that's just a Facebook troll. Those trolls have showed up. Mm-hmm. In San Luis Obispo, California, a guy was commenting on the mayor's Facebook page, showed up at City Hall and attacked somebody. So you have to take those things very seriously.
Absolutely. Margo, would you ever run for office?
No.
I'm actually surprised by that you say it so quickly. I think you would be a great elected.
Thank you. No. I don't like night events. I don't like raising money. And I have a really hard time with bullshit.
Period. Full
stop. So I think those just aren't going to play to my strengths. And I also, but maybe it would be my superpower. I also went to high school with a lot of politically connected families. And some of those people are in offices now across the state and nationally. And it's really disappointing to see how people who have, I mean, when you were talking about the norms associated with the orientation, there's also just a lot of old money and networks of old money that keep people in places of power. And so it's not just the identities that make it challenging, but it's like if you're not part of those clubs.
You're so right. And Barbara talks about that all the time, that there are so many structural barriers for women because they don't have access to what Barbara calls the old boys club.
Yeah, or the golf club.
But it's all of the private
or...
clubs, the golf course. It's the corporate boards, because women, and especially women of color, are vastly underrepresented on corporate boards. Wow. So their access to money and people that are going to listen is just a lot lower. That's absolutely true. And that's why Barbara likes to say that she's building the New Girls Network, because for hopefully all of the women that do get elected, they will make sure to help other women that are coming in behind them.
I love that. Tashira, what about you?
Aside from being the High Priestess of Thoughtlandia, which is an elected role that I take very seriously, as you know, Margo, we enact the...
presiding thoughtician.
Yes, presiding thoughtician. I have the White Toenail Season manifesto to really, you know...
Like our Constitution.
So similar.
Declaration of Independence.
And so aside from that role, you know, I find any job or any position where I'm not able to be my full self at all times to be so, it's almost like it feels too stifling to be worth the opportunity. And that's why I think elected officials who are principled and who are people who really go into this for the right reasons should receive all the praise and our support in a myriad of ways, because I know that I am not that person. I talk too much about anal. Ah! I couldn't do that if I wasn't elected.
I mean, if you were a man.
This is true.
Well, I think that's a good point, Tashira, about political courage is so important and something that we don't see very often in these times. It can be scary, but I think back to Senator Heitkamp, who voted against Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation, knowing that that would cause her to lose her election, which she did, but she went with her principles. And I wish that we saw more people go with their value system and talk about it if it's against what their district wants, rather than just listening to donors and other influencers.
Mm. But to Tashira's point, and to kind of push back on her a little bit, maybe there needs to be more people talking about things that we're not accustomed to women talking about to break some of those molds. So you can do that.
Yeah, I know. I think that's right. And when that person comes who's willing to do it, I will support them in all the ways. I'm just saying it ain't gonna be me. And I used to think that I was really interested, but it was more about being committed to social justice in a particular way. And I think this podcast does the same thing.
So. Yeah. And I think that there, you know, I think one of the things that I admire so much about your work and the foundation's work is that it's based on data and statistics that show a gap, but also show a path. And I think we can think about the status of our country from a lot of different ways. One is a very sad orientation, but there's also a lot of hope.
Absolutely. There's so much hope. And Barbara always talks about how for centuries, women have really been the backbone of every social movement in this country. They may not have been recognized for it.
For sure.
And what we've seen, especially post-2017, are women who are activated into politics because something affects their family or their community. Maybe they start volunteering, get involved with an organization. All of a sudden, they're working on a campaign. Next thing you know, they're running for office. And a lot of those women are in Congress now. And I think that that is very hopeful. You look at someone like Congresswoman McBath, who lost her son to gun violence, got involved in the anti-gun violence movement, ran for Congress, and now she's a congresswoman. It's a really sad tragedy that she took and made it into something that is going to change a lot of lives, potentially. And we've seen so many women activated by politics that way. Barbara always says that women don't run for office to seek fame and fortune. They do it to help people. And I think that's really true.
Yeah. So with that in mind, are there elected officials that we should be watching or certain jurisdictions for us to keep in mind? We really want our entire community to get galvanized and support.
Absolutely. I think everybody should first look at women in their own communities, in their own city, their own state, and see what the delegation looks like, see who is out there doing the work in the community. We've heard so many stories of women who ran against men in office that wouldn't take meetings with the women and kind of diminished their importance. And I think that there's still room for that to happen and more of that change as well. So I think first looking at that and seeing how people can get involved locally, because there are so many women that don't get as much attention. And because of the way that power structures work in state parties, they may not, the head of the party might not give a woman a chance to run at a seat unless it looks like she has community support and she's able to show she has followers. So I think it's also really exciting to see how the next generation of women in Congress have been communicating. And I think that we have seen a much different level. Anyone that comes into our organization that we ask who do they admire that's an elected official, almost everyone says Congresswoman AOC. Mm-hmm. And I mean, her Instagram lives, she is just such an incredible communicator. And I think that as we see more younger women elected to office, we will see a much different communication style. And it seems like people really want that.
You know how I feel about AOC.
So, me too.
Absolutely. I think what AOC, Ayanna Pressley, and Ilhan Omar and others have done in Congress has been nothing short of inspirational and I think encouraging to watch and to see. And I am someone who, for the most part, has a pretty skeptical eye at our democracy and a two-party system. And so they give me hope for what the future could look like. And so I'm so happy that you brought their work up.
If I can just say really quickly for Congresswoman Pressley, who's our congresswoman, she is an example of somebody who didn't wait her turn. She ran against
Capuano,
who was a sitting congressman. And a lot of people said at the time, he's a safe vote. Why would we be risking this seat? And my boss, on a personal level, went way out for Ayanna Pressley when nobody else was. A lot of people are now revising history, but she was fearless and said, no, Ayanna's going to be a much better candidate. She's going to actually be a bold voice in Congress and advocate for people. And look at what she's done.
Absolutely.
She is a national figure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we shouldn't just be looking for a safe vote all the time and actually be looking for people that are going to be fearless and speak out on behalf of others. I'm going to start crying.
I know.
But it's amazing to see those changes. And I think that we need to work to change our friends and family and neighbors' opinions around who is electable and the status quo and challenge people's misogyny when they make comments like she's just not likable or I'd vote for a woman.
Or she's too much like a professor.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Warren had a very low likability rating, our sitting senator. And in many ways, you know, whether people voted for her or not, she was a really incredible candidate and had a lot of amazing, relatable experience as a senator on deeply understood our banking system and poverty and public benefits. She was a public education teacher. She was a single mother, right? So, however you feel, but the fact that people didn't like her
You can have every qualification in the book. Yeah. And it goes to likability, which is highly subjective, which mm-hmm. is the place where biases reside, mm-hmm. right? Anytime you have subjective opinions is where your implicit biases are going to reign the most true. So we are so happy that you came and you joined us today. We will have all the resources that we mentioned down in the show notes. We end the show with a toast.
Yes, so Amanda, thank you for educating us and helping us better understand where we are and where we're going, which gets us to our toast, which is to more women and femmes in places where conversations are happening, however we get there and however it looks.
Cheers.
10 toes down, however we get there, period. See you guys next time.